deep down, I suppose, I'd subconsciously said to myself, I'm going back Amblin. Took a while to actually physically do it, but I was preparing myself for it.
And me being me, all secretive, and I wasn't going to tell anyone how I was feeling. I wasn't going to sit down with my counsellor and say, look, things aren't going well for me, you know, again, because my ego told me that I knew what I had to do. And my pride and my ego and all those things. And Pat knows it all. And, you know, Pat's been there, done it. Except Pat had been there and done it, but he didn't know how to deal with it.
And when I did go back, it was horrific. It was like totally off the scale. From the amounts I was gambling, from the amounts I was stealing, the amounts I was legitimately earning and spending, amounts I was borrowing off of friends. It just took over my whole life from late 2015 to the day I got locked up.
Like the first time after I had the long period away from gambling, you know, the stakes were a little bit higher or whatever. This time it was just insane. I mean, absolutely off the wall insane. The regularity, the sizes of the bets, the fact that I could now do it online. In a very short space of time, I'd practically become a part-time recluse, I suppose, would be. Going to bed with two phones and an iPad, having them all on the go, different websites, different gambling sites, not getting to sleep either until 4 or 5 in the morning or until I ran out of money, either or. And then waking up again next morning at 6, 7 o'clock to get back online, to get something in Australia instead of America. Before, when I gambled, I had gambled with the pure intent of getting rich. That one big win that I knew was going to change my life and all that kind of stuff. And that was the main reason why I gambled. Now I gambled and I didn't actually give a fuck. I didn't care whether I won or lost. I actually did not care. And I don't know why I kept doing it, but I actually couldn't stop. I actually could not stop. I quite literally was two different people. Completely two different people. Actually, it was more than two different people. There were so many different personalities going on around that time. You know, there was the sane, normal me. There was the lunatic me. There was the gambling me. There was the me that wanted to do away with myself. There was the me that was avoiding the guards. There was me. Like, I had so many plates spinning around and around and around all the time in my head. I genuinely don't know how I didn't have a stroke. Everything that I had, everything that I wanted was gone as I knew it. Like, I had no semblance of normality in my life at all.
From Wine Tavern Productions in association with Go Loud, this is The Gambler, Episode 6, Out of Control. Between 2015 and 2020, Pat's scamming hit an all-time high. He conned countless people and businesses, earning himself tens of thousands of euro through deception and fraud.
I could be very convincing, and I knew I could be very convincing. I rang up pretending to be working for RTE as a researcher. I would have pretended that I was doing product reviews and checking this out and that out, and I would have, I was kind of engaged into conversation with these people. I would have been more than able to hold my own in a conversation with them. And that's what it boils down to, I suppose, is getting somebody to trust you enough to part with whatever they were parting with. And that's what I'm unfortunately good at. I began to put a bit more thought into what I was doing in relation to products that people might need, like phones and things like that. I might look at what phones are very popular on the market, what's the biggest selling phone from a price point of view, what would I make the most profit on. I would have contacted companies, got phones from them on credit. With the last one that I got the 18-month sentence for, I contacted them telling them that I was doing some sort of a documentary and that I needed to use an iPad as part of it, that the fictitious company that I'd made up could use the iPad and that we'd give promotion or a plug during it, blah, 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 blah.
he bought it hook, line and sinker. He actually drove straight in and met me in Euston Station within 2 hours and handed it to me. I went and sold that straight away because I knew they were brand new iPads, they were worth money. I think I got 600 quid for it. And I was going back home on the train, probably having lost the 600 quid in Paddy Power's across from where I sold it. And I just said to myself, this is handy enough. I left it go maybe a week or a few days and I rang him back. And I told him that, look, I was in the market for buying stuff with regard to my job, etc., etc. I had gotten to a point with him very quickly where he trusted me. He believed everything that I had to say. And he gave me maybe 4 phones on credit and opened up an account for me straight away under a fictitious name. Didn't do any. No, I'm not saying that this was his own fault. It wasn't. But if he did any kind of due diligence on me, he'd have found out that the whole thing was a scam straight away and shut it down. And I would have walked away or ran from it straight away. But unfortunately, he didn't. And I went back to the well maybe 3 times after that, and I got somewhere in the region of 12 to 15 grand's worth of stuff off. I knew I was going to get caught from day one. But I'd done it already a couple of times years previous to this and gotten away with it because the companies involved, I figured, might have been too ashamed to report it or had insurance to cover it. That's the way that worked out. But I'm sure that if I did sit down and try to pen a proper good scam with an exit strategy, I probably would be able to. And I don't know whether it's my subconscious that wanted to get caught all the time. I genuinely don't know. But I can honestly tell you that practically every scam I pulled, I always left the door open, either by using my own name, my own phone number, or made it very easy for me to get caught. Like, I would have went into a lot of these places and collected the phones myself. At the time, I was 28 and a half stone, red hair and glasses. I kind of stick out like a sore thumb, and they all have CCTV. Like, I knew these things were always going to come back and bite me. But I was so desperate at the time just to get the money, get the bets on, because my mentality kept telling me that I was never that far away from the big win that was going to change my life.
So we've spoken to a number of Pat's victims over the years, and one of them in particular kind of stands out to me. He's an elderly man now, very successful in his field, and he didn't want to appear on this podcast because he was afraid that Pat might come back and go after him again. Now, I don't think that's likely, but it's an indication of the fear and the lasting impact of deceptions that can, you know, on the surface of things seem quite small. And the thing is, this man, Pat has scammed him twice already. And I thought that was, you know, pretty remarkable in itself.
The first one would have been quite a few years ago now, around the mid-2000s. It was a Pat classic, essentially. He shows up at this stranger's house out in the countryside and gives him the usual story. His bags were lost or stolen. He's got no wallet. He's only in the country for a few days. Maybe he's just off a plane from Shannon or something. A mutual acquaintance gave him Armand's number. Could he borrow some money to get him through this sticky patch, and he'll pay him back in a few days when he gets home? So this man, on the basis of the mutual acquaintance, gives him a couple of hundred quid in cash and never hears from Pat again.
Well, actually, that's not quite true. He does hear from him again. He just doesn't quite realise it at the time. Around 10 years later, I think, in 2017, this guy gets a phone call from someone claiming to be from RTE. Says he's looking to borrow a horse box for some documentary they're making, and that, again, someone suggested our man might be able to help. So again, still a trusting guy, he says, sure. Arrangements are made to drop off the horse box at a location in Limerick City Centre, and again, that's the end of it. The horse box disappears, Pat is in the wind, and eventually our man goes to the guards. Of course, they figure it all out pretty quickly. The horse box is recovered. Our man realises it's the same fella who scammed him before, and when it all shakes out in court, Pat is sentenced to 6 months in jail because of it.
It's all trivial stuff, really, like really low-level grifting. But I think it's interesting for a couple of reasons. One, that Pat would go back to the same guy a second time. He was able to do it all over the phone, all remotely, so there was much less chance of being recognised. But still, it's kind of a crazy thing to do. And secondly, it shows how even quite small things like this can have a major impact on people. This guy was genuinely afraid of Pat now. He was genuinely hurt by the deception. It made it harder for him to trust people, and it made him feel stupid, you know. And sure, he got his horse box back, but he's going to have to live with that feeling like, God, how could I be so stupid? He'll have to live with that for a long time. He's not going to get over that.
You know, he's not the only one.
One day my phone rang, and it was Patrick.
This is Kieran Ring again. We heard from him in a previous episode. He worked with Pat for about 18 months back in the mid-90s.
He said, I want to run something by you. I set it up to hear it. It was a weekend, or it was the month of a big rugby decider at the Aviva. Tickets were like hen's teeth, right? So I said to him, okay, so you have 6 of these tickets. He said, I do, but I'm not getting them at face value. I'm getting at them. And I went, well, maybe that doesn't matter so much. I mean, it's very good of you to think of us.
Kieran's brother, Brendan, is the head of a foundation that supports the families of children with complex care needs. After speaking with Pat, Kieran called Brendan to discuss the idea of auctioning the tickets to raise money for the foundation.
And they said, we'll pay the premium and we'll auction them. And, you know, we might get back twice the money. But other than that, it's a good thing anyway. So when my brother called me back, he said, I'm actually meeting Patrick now. And I said, oh, wow, okay, wow, that's quick. He said, yeah, I've got to give him the money to buy the tickets. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, it was 900, if I'm not mistaken. And I went, and then what's the next part? And he said, then he'll get the tickets, he'll get them to me, and we'll get on with the auction. And it's a pretty simple situation. So we met him and gave him the money on my say-so, which is the only way to say it. The tickets never arrived. There never was an auction. And we were to learn later that it was a particular scheme that he liked to do around tickets and games. It seemed to be something that he enjoyed doing. But on this occasion, it only mattered to us. We were very hurt by it. To take it from children and families that are struggling to get to the hospital today and pay the B&B and so on, I mean, do you have any idea at what you've done?
After chasing Pat for some time, Brendan did eventually manage to get the money back. After offering up several excuses and explanations, which all turned out to be untrue, Pat did finally leave the money for him to collect from a shop in Limerick. Brendan thought that Pat maybe didn't realise there was a charity involved at first, and that this had all been a personal thing. That's certainly the version Pat gave us when we put the story to him.
I genuinely have very little recollection of that. Very little. I do remember taking the money off him, but I, under no circumstances, was that for anything to do with a charity or raffling tickets or anything like that. Absolutely not. And I know that family a long time, and I'd imagine pretty much with the foundation and things like that that they have gone, that if there's any kind of impropriety about that, he would have been into Henry Street Garda Station straight away. But I don't think you'll ever find any kind of a paper trail or anything or any kind of a trail on that that leads back to that, because that did not happen the way you described it to me. And I'm sorry if I'm getting defensive about that, but...
But how did it happen? Because you're saying you've no recollection of it.
I remember... I have no recollection of anything to do with a chat with tickets being auctioned or raffled or anything like that for foundation. No. My recollection of that, quite simply, is I knew Kieran. I was talking to Kieran. Brendan wanted to go to the match. Can you help Brendan get tickets for the match? Yeah. I met Brendan. I got paid for the tickets from him. Then the tickets didn't turn up. I couldn't get them. I arranged to meet him in town. I met him in a coffee shop. Costa, I think it was, in Cruising Street. I sat down with him. We had a great chat. Gave him back his money and he walked out the door happy. That's exactly what happened there. And I'll say that as true as my mother's sitting at home with Alzheimer's. So if he's saying anything else to the contrary, he can say what he wants. But I know where I am on that.
That's a very detailed memory.
It's a memory.
But you just told us you don't remember very little. You remember very little about it. You don't remember.
I actually didn't even remember it until you brought it up there. About half an hour ago, it was something that I'd completely and utterly forgotten about. And there's probably 100 other instances of things like that over the years that I've done where I've repaid money to people where there's been no...
Well, that's all we're trying to do is to get your
yeah.
recollection of that and other things.
Like I said to you at the start, if I had to write a recollection of every single thing that I did, there wouldn't be enough time between now and the year 3000. I can't, you know, certain things jog certain things with me. I don't know.
Should I keep asking you questions, or?
Yeah.
All right. See how far we get. This kind of ticket scam was Pat's bread and butter in the years before he went to prison in 2020. From what we can tell, he used some variation of it over and over again. And what he did to the Ring family was a simple version of it. Other people, people like Margaret Molloy, were on the receiving end of a much more complex variety.
It was April 2019. I got a phone call from the proprietor of the bar where we as a supporters club met. I'm chair of Dublin Spurs official supporters club. The Diageo rep had been on and they could get tickets to the semi-final, which Spurs were in against Ajax, if any of the members wanted them. So I'd initially said no. My husband had just passed away and we were both season ticket holders, and I thought if I never see Spurs again, it would be too soon. And I wasn't really the Spurs fan. It was him, to be honest, and I wasn't in a good place. I wasn't long back in work. And I got off the phone and a colleague, a young guy, said, did I just hear you get the opportunity for semi-final tickets? And he said, no. And I said, yeah. I said, I'm not going to go. And he said, I'll take them. Semi-final Champions League mags, you know, probably never happened again in our lifetime. I was like, yeah, whatever, okay. So I said, I rang back and said, look, yeah, Brian was, Duffy, I think was the name. He was giving up the Diageo rep. I said, give him my number. There's a lad here. I'll take a couple of tickets off him. So I got a phone call back from a Brian Duffy in Diageo to say that yes, Guinness had access to a couple of tickets. They'd just be face value. They weren't corporate or they weren't VIP or anything. The Diageo rep took himself out of the picture when I confirmed I wanted the tickets. He said, right, I'll put you in touch with Pat Sheedy, who has the tickets and runs a media, sports media company down in Galway. And then I got a phone call from Pat.
He called himself Sheehy.
Sheehy, yeah, I keep getting that wrong. Sheehy, he told me he was Patrick Sheehy from Galway. Yeah, so he could get me too. And I paid him, and then there was another phone call to say, look, it's looking like I can get you another two. And I think it was seven in total then he could get. They were to come here, the tickets, and he was to meet me with them. He was to meet me at Dublin Airport with them. Anyway, it never happened. And then he was in Brussels and he'd meet us in Amsterdam with the tickets. And we all went, yeah, this is not going to happen, guys. But we were down 70 quid ahead and we were going to watch it in the square in Amsterdam. And how bad. So he said, look, they'll be waiting for you at the reception of the stadium. And even then we were like, oh, the stadium is so far out. There's nothing around. We're not even going to make it back to a pub to watch the game. If, you know, everybody thought at this stage, nah, it's not going to happen. But I said, look, we have to go and see. So we jumped on the equipment of the Lewis and off we went. And I queued at the desk. And lo and behold, a very nice Tottenham Hotspur representative gave me an envelope with my name on it, but there were six tickets in it. So Pat rang me to say, I said, I have only six tickets, not seven. He actually said, oh, put me onto the guy at the desk, which I did. I handed the guy on the desk my phone. And the conversation was, yeah, there's only six here with her name on them and therefore she's only getting six. So one of the guys had to hot foot it back to a pub to watch it. So the six was good in and we won in the dying minutes. And we were at breakfast the next morning and Pat rang, congratulated us on our win, to say that he could possibly get tickets to Champions League final in Madrid. So everybody's ecstatic and I had no reason to doubt him. And as he kept reminding me, I got your tickets to the semi-final. He promised us two and then another two and another two, and I was transferring the money. They were 450 actually a ticket, so he got 900, then it was 450 and then it was another 900, less the 70 he owed us from Amsterdam. He was very good in ensuring that I got the 70 euros back from the Amsterdam trip that never was. That was basically it. He could get us these tickets. They were coming in by courier. Security was meeting the courier at Dublin Airport. I'm thinking better now. We were just all so excited here. And they were to be delivered to my job, and then he got delayed in traffic. and we all stayed here and worked, myself and a couple of the lads, and they never came. And then the next day he said they did come, and we ran around the building like lunatics, accusing all sorts of staff of taking our UEFA tickets. And then it was, no, they didn't. He had them, not to worry. He'd meet me at Dublin Airport with them, and I sat in Dublin Airport and he never showed. And then it was he'd meet us in Madrid at the hotel. What hotel was I staying at? Gave him our hotel details. We hung around the hotel. No tickets, no Mr. Sheedy. And then it was, I'll do what I did in Amsterdam. They'll be at the stadium for you. And we headed out. And I don't know if you know the stadium in Madrid. It's outside the city. So we got on a coach in the blazing heat and headed out to the stadium. And then they only allow you in so far without a ticket. And then we were snookered and I was ringing him. And he was like, leave it with me, I'm ringing you back. And he rang me back, bawling to say UEFA had shafted him and his business was gone. He said he was there himself. And he said, actually, I'm in the office here with them and I've been arrested for causing such a scene. I'm here with the equivalent of the Spanish police. And he was crying on the phone. I actually felt sorry for him. And then in Madrid, we didn't even get to see the game because we were literally outside the stadium. And in fact, it's all coming back to me now, he told me to buy off the touts and he'd reimburse us. Imagine we had of. Not that we ever would. We wouldn't have had the money because they were looking for thousands. But for me, as I say, it was letting us go all the way over in the blistering heat. It's that aspect of it. We spent hundreds on flights and we didn't even get to see the game. I thought, why would you do that?
Margaret reimbursed all the other Spurs fans the money they'd spent on tickets, which was over 3,000 euro, and then waited for Pat to pay her back. But the money was not forthcoming. On the 30th of July, 2 months after the final, Pat lodged 500 euro into her account. At this point, she still had no reason to believe she'd been scammed.
How long was this going on?
Months. Months from the time it had, from Madrid. Yeah, it was going on months.
And he was still promising, I'll pay you back, I'll pay you back.
Oh yeah, he was up. I actually, myself and my friend took her disabled daughter to Westlife. Oh, he was there with his nieces and he'd meet me after the game and give me the money. And like a fool, again, I waited. And then it's like, oh, the nieces took sick. He had to drive them home. Then there was a solicitor, and again, I feel all of this documented. There was a solicitor in Capel Street who would be dealing with it, and I'd have to sign an affidavit. And again, I said, yeah, no problem. She said, there's no solicitor on Capel Street.
There was no solicitor on Capel Street. Just like there was no Diageo rep. And there was no sports media company either. It was just Pat, at every stage.
And one of the things was he gave me a Galway address even. And my brother's in Galway. And I said to my brother, look, I don't intend going down and meeting this man, but when you just check out for me, does he live there? And can you find out any information on him? This is when I wasn't sure. I hadn't confirmed that he wasn't who he said he was. And he gave me an address in Galway. And my brother came back and he said, that's an elderly couple living there. Very dangerous thing to do. You know, you need to be fairly sure you're not dealing with somebody who would go down and pay that elderly couple a visit thinking that he is connected to them. All the texts, all the emails, it was constant for weeks upon weeks upon weeks. He was meeting me, he wasn't meeting me, he was selling the car, solicitors in Capel Street. Like, you're talking hundreds of texts, hundreds of emails. So it wasn't even just in Madrid, guess what? There's no tickets, sorry, I'm not going to be able to pay you back. Because that would have been the end of it. I'd have been angry. But it wasn't, it was the constant drip, drip of, I'm getting it to you, bear with me, couple of quid here, I'm not, you know, patchy. Fess up and let that be the end of them. We'll all get on with our lives, you know. But no, and I don't know what he gets out of playing this stupid game of, you know, I am going to give it to you and bear with me and I've lost my livelihood and, you know, I'm going to sell the car and I'll meet you outside the concert. Even time, which we're all precious, but we don't know how long we have in this world, you know. I just don't get why somebody would play the game to the extent he played it, because there was nothing extra in it for him by doing this. Do you know, the game was up, I'd no tickets, and he had the money. End it there, for Christ's sake. Why are you torturing us? Why are you torturing me? I was out with a girlfriend. We were doing an overnight and we're out having a gin and tonic out, and she said to me, "Do you think you've been done? Do you think he's legit?" You know, I was filling her in, and I said, "I've no reason to doubt him." I said, as he keeps pointing out, he got me the tickets for Amsterdam, and we did get them at the foyer. Like, it all adds up. I've no reason to doubt him. And she Googled, and she put in, I don't know what she put in. She obviously put in, I don't know, fraudster, conman, whatever. When my pal Googled him and just showed me her phone, my heart sank. It just sank.
Margaret did eventually get some of her money back from Pat. He paid her that initial €500 and then another €1,000 later on. But even so, she and her fellow Spurs fans were down thousands of euro between the tickets, the travel and the accommodation.
More important than the money, though, was the sense of embarrassment, that sickening feeling of having had the wool pulled over your eyes, of having been ripped off.
You know, I was very fragile and vulnerable when all this went down, and I kind of put it down to that as well. I thought, oh, maybe another time I wouldn't have been conned, but I think I would have been because he was so good. Like, none of the lads were alarmed about anything. And then I have to say, I saw red when I saw he'd written a book. And the fact that I say he blocked me on social media would suggest to me he hasn't changed his ways at all, and he certainly hasn't come to terms or at peace with what he's done. And don't get me wrong, as I said, I'd be all for anybody making a fresh start, and I don't think anyone should have to spend their life being punished for mistakes that they made. You know, he didn't murder anyone. He didn't hurt anyone other than financially and maybe ego. But when I heard he wrote a book, and I just thought, oh, wow, hang on a second. Like, talk about Walter Mitty. You know, Catch Me If You Can has nothing on him.
I was in London for a weekend. I was going to a match. I had friends in London that I used to visit quite a lot. I was going to a match. I was getting a train in from Stansted, and it just so happened there was two big matches in London that day, and I didn't know which one I was going to go to because I actually had tickets for both and an option to go to both. And I decided on the way in that I'd go to a football game with my friends rather than the rugby game I was going to go to. And it so happened that I had four actually legitimate corporate tickets for the Premiership rugby final, which was on the same day. And on the train in from Stansted, there was a lot of supporters. And I got talking to a guy on the seat across from me. He was wearing a big Gloucester rugby jersey. I think they were in the final the same day. And we just struck up a conversation on the way in. And then about 10 minutes before we pulled into Liverpool Street, I just thought, I'm not going to use these tickets. So I gave them to him. I said, look, take the tickets, enjoy the day. He said, give me your number. And that was the big mistake. I gave him my number. He went, he had a great day, and rang me about a week later to thank me. Couldn't get over how great a day he had. And we talked about rugby, we talked about matches. Nice fella, really nice fella. And then, me being me, where I was at that time with the gambling and all that, I started scheming, started thinking in my mind, and I started looking upon him as an opportunity. I knew he had a really good job. He obviously wasn't short of a few quid. And we struck up a conversation where he asked me if I could get him Rugby World Cup tickets. There and then, I just said yes straight away. Didn't know whether I could or couldn't. There was a chance I could, there was a chance I couldn't, because that's the way I always operated. And I said, yeah, sure, shoot me off a list of whatever games you're looking for. So he shoots me over a list. Next thing I know, he's asking me for my bank details, insists on paying me in advance. I didn't even have to work at it. So he paid me. Great. A couple of grand in the bank account straight away. That was me sorted for the weekend's gambling or whatever. My mind telling me then, sure, I'll make money out of this. I'll be able to pay him back if it goes wrong. The usual mentality.
Would you have had access to get tickets from somewhere?
Yeah.
Because you were working at the time.
I worked at the time. I would have had a lot of corporate contacts, and I would have had history working in around rugby clubs years ago as well. So I would have had a network of people that I could have called on when I needed them.
And you'd never burned any of those?
Never burned those bridges, because I knew deep down if I burned the bridges, that'd be me fucked. I wouldn't be able to get what I needed to get going forward. So I always was fairly cute as to what I did and how I did it. So I always maintained good relationships with the people that could provide me with genuine tickets when I needed them. Then he rang me again about a couple of weeks after that, and he said, look, if there's any chance you can help me, I've got another couple of friends. I was like, Jesus, I don't even have to work at this. And I suppose within 3 weeks, I think he'd given me the bones of €6,000-€7,000. Around that time, there was a, because I was thinking, Jesus, this is handy. Do I know anybody else looking for World Cup tickets? and I rang a client, an ex-client that I used to do a lot of work with because I knew he was into the rugby, and I said, look, because I needed money that day, I figured like this could be quick. I rang him, gave him the spiel, I can get you, you know, yeah, I need them. Paid me straight away. So they were the two incidents. Then when the competition obviously came up, he was looking for his tickets. I couldn't get them. The usual bullshit for me. I wouldn't take phone calls. I put him on the long finger. I tell him lies, all the while trying to scramble together the money to repay him to cover my own arse. But that never happened. And he just got fed up waiting and asking. And he went about whatever he had to do. He made his report to his local police station at home. Whatever the procedure is then, they contacted the Gardaí here, who contacted my local station in Henry Street. And the other guy did the same.
I think one of these guys was Peter Whiteside, an elderly man who works kind of with or for an amateur rugby club in London.
Yeah, we found some remarks from Mr. Whiteside related to this scam, or at least something very like it, when the whole thing came to court a few years later.
His memory of the whole episode is quite different. The way he tells it, he got a call from someone claiming to be from an Irish rugby club, a friend of a friend sort of thing, who said that another friend of his had tickets for the Rugby World Cup. Would Peter's club be interested in taking them? Whiteside was interested and he said, sure, give the guy my number. So the friend of a friend of a friend calls him and says he'd happily supply Whiteside with the tickets. Whiteside transfers the money, time goes by, no tickets arrive. Eventually, he finds a number for the guy who first contacted him, who says to him, Peter, I'm sorry, but I've never spoken to you before in my life. So obviously Whiteside now thinks that it was Pat all along.
He was behind all of the calls and he got the money. I did try speaking to Peter Whiteside about this, but he wasn't in the mood to talk about it. He's still quite sore about the whole thing.
I called members of my rugby club. Yes. I'm at a rugby club out of €7,000. That's the bottom line.
Yeah.
I have nothing else to say. I know he's not going to pay it back. It's €7,000 from innocent amateur rugby supporters. So I refuse to speak about him anymore.
While Margaret Molloy hasn't yet had her day in court with Pat, this episode with Mr. Whiteside was one of the scams that finally landed Pat in prison in 2020. He was still there in late 2022 when we first heard from him. And that, I suppose, is where our part of the story really begins.
The Gambler is produced and presented by Nicola Tallant and me, Ian Molini. The executive producer for Go Loud is Owen Brennan, and Darren Cleary is the commissioning editor for Go Loud. Sound design is by Neil Kavanagh. The Go Loud promotion design and video team for The Gambler is Roisin Riley, Siobhan Walsh, Cameron Rooney, Andrew McConnell, and Dara Murphy. Legal support was from Mars Solicitors. If you have been affected by any of the issues raised in this series, you can contact Gambling Care on 1800 936 725 or visit gamblingcare.ie.